All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, the Honorable John Schmidt presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. You may be seated. We have six cases on the calendar this morning, four of which are for argument, and we'll have the marshal call the first case, please.
A231371, in the matter of civil commitment of Norbert Hugo Salinas.
All right. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for the rebuttal. Feel free to get settled at the podium. There's little buttons right underneath the podium that you can raise and lower it. Take your time getting ready, but when you're ready, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Winkler. I'm attorney for the appellant Norberto Salinas, and may it please the court. Since his commitment, Mr. Salinas has maintained that he has had one victim. Essentially, from the moment he was detected and arrested, he has acknowledged he sexually assaulted his 30-year-old victim. He has denied assaulting the other three people he was alleged to have victimized, and those four victims formed the basis of Mr. Salinas' commitment in 2010, largely. While in treatment at MSOP, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, Mr. Salinas has taken seven polygraph tests. None of those tests showed deception, including the full disclosure poly he took in November of 2014.
I have a quick question about that.
Yes.
But all of them form the basis for his commitment. Am I correct? Not just the one that he admits.
Yes, the commitment order from 2010 indicates that Mr. Salinas was committed based on the sexual assaults of four separate victims. It is that Mr. Salinas has denied offending against three of those persons and has admitted sexually offending against one.
But it's sort of a curious due process question. I mean, having been committed on that basis, and now it seems like you're arguing in part that, well, you can't really hold against him the fact that he's not acknowledging those violations. It seems as if hasn't he lost the opportunity to argue that? I mean, having given the nature of the basis for the commitment?
Our argument is that treatment decisions at MSOP have been made based on the fact that Mr. Salinas successfully passed those polygraph tests and his interactions with his treatment and support staff at MSOP. And those treatment decisions were that the focus of Mr. Salinas' treatment would be on his one admitted victim. And when asked to report on his victimization of others, the nature of those, the details of those, his treatment for going on a decade now has focused on that one victim. So I don't envision this as a due process question, or that Mr. Salinas is necessarily attempting to relitigate his commitment. What we are pointing out is that MSOP is responsible for Mr. Salinas' treatment, and MSOP has made a determination that that treatment would focus on his one admitted victim.
Okay, I understand your argument better now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the question. And so as I just touched on, Mr. Salinas' treatment work has been focused on that single victim. The record demonstrates for a series of years after that polygraph test, Mr. Salinas receiving...
So I have a question for you, though. How does that make out a prima facie case? Because the experts, the witnesses, all said to the contrary. So how does that amount to a prima facie case?
And I certainly appreciate the difficulty in making out a prima facie case when, As I'll discuss, the examiners in this case take considerable exception with the treatment that MSOP has provided Mr. Salinas, calling it misguided and perplexing. What I would note is that based largely on the same record in 2019, the commitment appeal panel ordered that Mr. Salinas be transferred to CPS. The transfer and provisional discharge criteria obviously have their differences, but based largely on the same record, a panel was able to determine that Mr. Salinas's course of treatment was sufficient that he could be transferred. And those same facts apply in this matter. The only difference, the major difference is in this case, we have an examiner that says Mr. Salinas's course of treatment at MSOP is completely misguided here.
Well, but even if that's so, putting a finer point on Judge Siegel's question, was there evidence presented by your client that, or argument that he presented no longer present a danger to the public? I mean, that, in order to make out a prima facie case, that you have to present a showing, even if you're right that the evaluator was too strict in its consideration, in her considerations, don't you still have to make that case with evidence?
We certainly do, and I believe the objective measures and the consideration of Mr. Salinas's treatment within the program, in other words, how he was being evaluated by the program itself regarding his participation in treatment, his performance in treatment, his behavioral compliance, his being a respected member of the workforce within the program, the other accolades that he has accumulated over his treatment, that those form the basis of the prima facie case that Mr. Salinas needed to build and present to the panel.
Well, what was the evidence that he was no longer a danger?
The evidence that he is no longer a danger is established through his performance and behavior in the program.
So the panel should have reached that conclusion even though there was no witness who made that, drew that conclusion from the evidence, or suggested that conclusion existed from the evidence.
I think if the evidence is considered in light most favorable to the appellant, which on the commissioner's motion to dismiss, I mean that is the prism through which the panel is looking at this evidence, that yes, there was sufficient evidence for the panel to draw that conclusion, and the panel in fact should have drawn that conclusion based on the extensive record and the amount of documentation about Mr. Salinas's performance and the testimony of his former primary therapist who had confirmed what was established in the reports about his behavioral compliance, about his what she described as great performance in the treatment program. That forms the basis that the CAP should have concluded when considering the evidence in a light most favorable to Mr. Salinas.
Did that witness testify that he's not a danger?
In her
report?
No, that witness did not testify specifically. And again, as the court has noted in other commitment appeal panel matters, a great deal of emphasis is placed on the opinion of experts, given the complexities of the issues and the necessities of an expert opinion and expertise in psychology and psychiatry that largely forms the basis of these opinions. That's what makes this issue so particularly troubling is when we have an examiner coming in and saying, you know, not that they simply had a disagreement with a decision that the treatment team had made, or, you know, there was you know, it could have been handled differently or better, but essentially negating almost a decade of treatment work because in this examiner's opinion, she feels that MSOP's treatment is misguided and perplexing. And then, again, it becomes very difficult to build a prima facie case at that point when the examiner is conflating her criticisms of MSOP's treatment and...
No, the panel didn't expressly adopt that conclusion as its own.
The conclusions that the panel made are clearly, and I would describe them as overwhelmingly influenced by the opinion of the examiner, where you have the panel reaching conclusions that Mr. Salinas needs to admit or should admit or is taking note that he has not admitted that he, in fact, has four victims instead of one victim, when that has never been a treatment prerogative at MSOP. He has never been asked throughout his treatment at MSOP to make that admission or that his treatment was based on the fact or being held up by the fact that he would not make that admission.
If you're correct about your challenges to Dr. Lovett's presentation and the panel's implicit reliance on it, why wouldn't the better approach be to remand for reconsideration without those concerns rather than ordering the provisional discharge?
And excuse me. The relief we are seeking today is that the court reverse or remand, understanding that the complexities that this issue creates when findings and conclusions are based so heavily and in some cases verbatim on the examiner's report and testimony, and that report and testimony calls into question the treatment program itself, that there needs to be there very well might need to be clarification in an order saying that it's trying to separate those two issues out, that we are either in support or opposed to Mr. Salinas's provisional discharge or discharge based on the actual merits of Mr. Salinas and his performance in the treatment program, and not on this particular examiner feels that MSOP has simply gotten his treatment wrong for the better part of a decade now. So we would be also asking that the court would remand this issue with instructions to clarify that order based on the examples that are included in this brief, which touch heavily on...
Am I correct? There's never actually been a determination by his treating professionals that there is in fact only one offense.
Well, and that's a very interesting question because Mr. Salinas went through years and years of treatment at MSOP where by all appearance and all account there certainly appeared to be an agreement with the sexual offense history. Again, he was receiving kudos from treatment providers based on his clear and concise explanation of his sex offense history. They seemed to take his explanation at face value. And again, this is going on for years. And that continues up until the point where he is actually ordered by the CAP panel to be transferred to CPS. And then at that point, it starts appearing in his annual reviews, for instance, that they do not have an agreed-upon sex offense history. Those comments didn't appear in annual or quarterly reviews prior to Mr. Salinas being transferred to CPS, and the timing that was established in trial and the testimony of his primary go to that point directly where his primary is indicating, yes, the fact that he got transferred to CPS caused MSOP in response to now say, well, actually, look at this issue. We don't have an agreed-upon sex offense history. And when he was before the CAP in 2019 and the issue of transfer to CPS was before the panel, The MSOP, the treatment program, was opposed to that transfer as well. But in that opposition, they never raised this as an issue. This was not an issue that was identified by the treatment team or by MSOP until after Mr. Salinas was transferred to CPS. So,
but what would you say the MSOP's opposition to the transfer in 2019, how does that bear? Doesn't that have some bearing now on whether or not these three other issues should be part of the analysis by the CAP?
I would say that those issues were captured in testimony by Chris Schiffer, who is the court liaison. And if the panel were to, or this court were to, review the order transferring Mr. Salinas to CPS, those criticisms of his treatment performance by MSOP at the time were addressed one after the other by the panel at that time and dismissed. I'm not saying that doesn't mean that they still don't hold relevance or that they are not worthy of consideration, but they were certainly insufficient at the time for the panel to conclude that transfer was appropriate. And again, the record is largely the same with the additions of since that CAP hearing, Mr. Salinas has been transferred to CPS. He is continued to do well in the program. It was noted that his performance, which often with clients transferring to CPS result in kind of a dip or lower scoring. That didn't happen with him. He's gaining privileges at CPS. That basis, in addition to the CAPS order in 2019, again, provide prima facie evidence that the panel could and should have relied on for provisional discharge and discharge. And I've exceeded my time. I thank you for your attention today.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal if you choose to use it. And counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, Leif McGregor on behalf of the commissioner. The commitment appeal panel's order dismissing Mr. Salinas' provision for provisional discharge and discharge should be upheld. The first and overriding reason for this is that Mr. Salinas did not meet his burden of production at the phase one hearing. He offered no competent evidence that he no longer needs treatment at CPS or that provisional discharge or discharge can be accomplished while protecting public safety. Second, Mr. Salinas' core argument on appeal regards whether the panel properly considered the phase one evidence in the light most favorable to him, as would be appropriate on a motion to dismiss. This argument is unavailing because Mr. Salinas cannot meet his burden by taking evidence that he offered off the record. He must be able to offer some competent evidence supporting provisional discharge or discharge, and he does not. I'll first address that core argument by the appellant. He challenges as improper expert evidence that he offered on the theory that it intrudes into the treatment decisions made at CPS. He also argues that there was improper credibility weighing of the evidence and that evidence is inadmissible. Before addressing these arguments in turn, it's important to recognize that this is all evidence that Mr. Salinas offered into the record. Because it was a phase one hearing on the issues of provisional discharge and discharge only, Mr. Salinas could have simply not offered this evidence, the evidence that he now challenges, and it would not have been on the record. To go through his arguments, first, the evidence that he offered is proper. The fact that Dr. Lovett and Dr. Edwards are critical of aspects of Mr. Salinas' treatment does not make their opinions improper. Neither Dr. Lovett nor Dr. Edwards offer an opinion on how Mr. Salinas should be treated. The panel's order does not purport to direct a course of treatment.
But their
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
But their risk assessment is based in part on a standard that apparently hadn't been applied to him in treatment. Do you agree with that? Regarding his particular element of the risk assessment being he doesn't acknowledge three of the four sex offenses that form the basis of his commitment.
Your Honor, I certainly agree that both Dr. Lovett and Dr. Edwards are skeptical of the claim that only one of the four offenses that were the basis for his commitment, that Mr. Salinas was responsible for only one of those offenses. That does not make their report improper. There's no obligation that they not have a critical eye toward the subject of their report.
Right, but if the treatment itself is based upon, I mean, if the question now is how he's doing in treatment and he's a danger because he doesn't acknowledge all four of the violations, but his treatment was based on, at least the argument goes, only one of the offenses because, and if you look, I mean, it is sort of strange, I think, and I could see why there might be some concerns by his treating professionals that, well, yeah, he was accused of these horrible things, but, I mean, the charges were reduced to, I mean, trespassing. I mean, a pretty minor offense, but suggesting that there might not have been much credibility to the, or much support for the actual charge. But in any case, how do you answer the question as to the reliance on the treatment?
Well, I don't think it can be denied that there is skepticism expressed in the reports, but I also don't think that it's fair to characterize that issue as the only issue that they're concerned by. Dr. Lovett talked about an inability to intervene in criminal thinking, about a lack of thorough investigation of the one sexual offense that he admits, talks about impression management and a general lack of transparency. I don't think that...
The idea is that he's generally continuing to minimize his culpability.
That's part of it, certainly. I think her conclusion that he has not been... He's not deeply explored the single offense that he admits, I think goes beyond the question of whether he should be treated for four or one. It's accepting the premise that the single offense that he admits to is the one that he should be treated for. But for both Dr. Lovett and Dr. Edwards, their brief is not to consider what the appropriate course of treatment is. Their brief is to consider the statutory factors. And there's nothing inappropriate about their approach to that task.
So appellant argues here that Mr. Salinas doesn't have a diagnosis anymore that would subject him to this kind of commitment. And so on what grounds does the state continue to hold him? The diagnosis is basically that, well, you were convicted of sex crimes before. I mean, yeah, but that means, I mean, if that's enough to hold him forever, you know, then he'll never get out. I mean, so explain that to me, how the state can still confine someone when they no longer have a qualifying diagnosis.
Your Honor, there's
Or is that an erroneous statement? Is that incorrect? Yeah.
It's not correct to say that there is such a thing as a qualifying diagnosis. The standard has to do with whether the committed individual has control over their sexual behavior. That can be associated with a paraphilia or a sexual disorder diagnosis, but there's no requirement that that happen. Mr. Salinas has varied diagnoses. Some talk about a personality disorder like antisocial personality disorder, and Dr. Lovett included the diagnosis of antipersonality disorder. But that's not a talisman under the law for continued commitment. The issue is that looking at his risk factors, his treatment record, the experts indicate that he continues to have a risk for reoffense, for sexual crimes, and that's sufficient under the law to continue.
But what in his treatment record, I mean, I guess that's the whole point, is that his treatment record says, hey, he's doing pretty well.
Well, Your Honor, his treatment record reflects, you know, his status in phase two. It does not, he has not entered phase three of treatment, which has to do with learning how to be in the public, mixed with the community. Although he is at CPS, he's not allowed even to move around CPS without an escort. So it's not, you can't say that because where he is in his treatment, he shows some success, therefore he doesn't reflect a risk to the public. That's not the nature of treatment progression under MSOP's program.
How would you, you know, we did ask counsel about evidence that was presented showing he's no longer a danger, and there was a response. How, what's the state's position on appellant's response that, yes, we did produce evidence that he's no longer a danger?
Your Honor, there was no evidence competent to support the statement that he's no longer a danger. The competent evidence on that issue came from Dr. Lovett and Dr. Edwards, both of whom said that he would present a danger to the public if released from CPS under either provisional discharge or discharge. Indeed, you know, one element of meeting his prima facie burden for provisional discharge is to present evidence indicating that the plan that he offered would protect the public. There was no evidence of any kind going to that issue. The fact that his treatment team gives him high scores in his what are called matrix factors indicates that he's cooperating with his treatment team. It doesn't indicate that he's not a danger to the public. There's nothing on the record that supports that leap in logic. Similarly, the fact that he is generally rule compliant while in an institution doesn't support the inference that he would continue to be rule compliant when not in the institution.
Can you explain something to me? There is a lot of reliance on the static, what is it, the 99R and the another test. How does somebody who's been committed for many years ever score well on those? Because kind of the protective community factors, how can you develop those when you're in a locked treatment setting away from the community for so many years?
Your Honor's correct that there are static factors that don't change over time. There are also dynamic factors that are considered in the risk assessment. I don't think either of the experts limited their analysis to the static factors. And although I'm not looking at the reports, I'm confident that they both acknowledge the issue of, you know, for example, one of the static factors has to do with whether you've been in a long-term successful relationship. That's not possible to achieve while institutionalized, but their analysis acknowledges that fact. So application of the static factors, I don't think can fairly be described as a way of presenting progression under the rubric that these kind of experts apply in assessing.
Well, but yet the experts relied upon those static factors to conclude that he's either an above average or well above average risk of recidivism.
Your Honor, the experts looked at the static factors and made that conclusion, but they applied other forms of analysis as well that supported the same conclusion.
Do you agree that the three other alleged offenses should not have been part of the consideration?
No, Your Honor. The fact that Mr. Salinas was committed on the basis of those offenses is an undisputed fact, and it's appropriate for the panel to note undisputed facts even when they're negative from the perspective.
Right, but after commitment, now you have a series of inquiries to test whether or not he actually did commit those offenses. And I think that, isn't that the reason for the repeated polygraphs?
Your Honor, the polygraphs go to treatment, not establishing a new history of his sex offenses. It's not, his treatment team's brief is not to...
But one of the questions he's asked is whether he committed those offenses. And why ask that question in a polygraph and then have him respond, no, I didn't, and the polygraph results in a no, he's not being deceptive. What's the purpose of asking those questions if not to consider whether those underlying offenses should continue to be part of his treatment?
The distinction is simply that the treatment team is designing a course of treatment, and to get there, they require an agreed history of offenses. It often goes far beyond examples of offenses like Mr. Salinas has, where he is prior admitted.
Right, but
previously.
Am I correct that there's no agreement at this point as to what his history of offenses are?
I think the distinction I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is simply that the lens through which the treatment team looks at it is not the lens of was commitment appropriate. They're trying to devise a treatment program.
No, I understand that. But then they ask the questions, did you commit the offenses? He says, no, I didn't. And I think that's part of developing the treatment. And whether it's designed to determine what his treatment is or just basically trying to determine whether or not he committed these offenses, the questions are asked. Is there ever an opportunity for a determination within the process to actually decide if there's not an agreement, what exactly the offenses are? Is there some type of an administrative process to say, okay, the parties don't agree, let's actually adjudicate the question and determine what are the offenses? Because I've always had due process concerns with the whole process. You've got an accusation made, a charge filed by law enforcement that goes nowhere with a prosecutor. Like, these charges don't even merit continued probable cause for trial. And yet, they form a basis for civil commitment. But then he continues to deny, and now he has the opportunity to have a polygraph to support his denials, and the polygraph does support his denials. Is there some way that he can... I don't want to say clear the record, but at least come to some determination as to what are the underlying offenses for treatment when there's disagreement?
So, and I'll address your question more directly in a second, but first I think it's important to note that he admitted to the sexual assault against the 9-year-old.
Right, that's not the one, right.
And although he didn't have a conviction for sexual offenses on some of the other charges, there was testimony from the victims at the commitment proceeding. So it's not as if this issue wasn't examined closely as part of the commitment. To answer your question as to what could he do, that is a writ of habeas corpus. There's no treatment process that's going to result in a decision that challenges the commitment order.
Not the commitment order. I mean, for treatment purposes, as I understand it, there's some process where the parties can agree as to the underlying concerns, and there's no agreement made. Is there a process to resolve that disagreement?
Your Honor, I don't think the process that you're imagining is the process that, in fact, is applied. MSOP is not a party to commitment proceedings. They don't have a stake in his commitment. What's happening in the treatment is MSOP is applying the treatment program with the goal of successful treatment resulting in provisional discharge or discharge. So there's no aspect of relitigating whether commitment was appropriate. The question for them is...
But I'm not talking about whether treatment is appropriate now at this point. I'm talking about... I mean, this whole dispute seems to hinge significantly on whether there's three or one, four offenses. And... it may not be the basis for our decision, as you're arguing that that's, you're saying that's not really what's in play here. But it seems to matter in this case, and it might in others, whether there's an agreement or not as to what the underlying basis for treatment is, not for commitment, but for ongoing treatment. And I'm just wondering, I gather you're saying, no, there's no process to determine, to resolve this disagreement where the parties don't agree.
Well, and maybe where I'm maybe the disconnect between my answer and your question has to do with the parties. If Mr. Salinas feels that he has a case that, where he can show that the four sexual offenses that were found, that he was found to have committed as part of his commitment, if he feels like he can provide evidence that those didn't happen, his relief for that is a writ of habeas corpus. It doesn't have to do with whether, you know, for purposes of treatment, the treatment team is accepting a different mix of sexual offenses. They're just different processes. The treatment process isn't adversarial in that nature, and it's MSOP is not a party to the commitment.
Thank you.
And counsel, I see you're out of time, so thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, thank you. First, in response to the conversation that Judge Ross had initiated, I would note that Mr. Salinas took a plea regarding the 9-year-old where it was described by counsel as that he admitted. Now, that also raises a sticky issue in the historical record that's before the court here, in that upon going to prison, now Mr. Salinas is faced with a treatment mandate, a mandate that if he wants to avoid civil commitment, he has to go to treatment. And he can't go to treatment if he is saying, well, I took a plea. I didn't say I actually committed the offense. How am I supposed to participate in treatment? And as was noted, the other two charges were reduced. I know one was noted to be trespass, the other regarding burglary. In response to what Judge Siegel had noted, and looking particularly at the discharge criteria in Call v. Gomez, and the fact that Mr. Salinas does not carry a sexual disorder, it's not only that he doesn't carry a sexual disorder, he has been treated by his treatment team for the better part of a decade as though he also does not have a habitual course of sexual offense. They have been treating him as though he has a single offense. So it's not only that we're saying that he does not have a sexual disorder, and perhaps that, as citing from case law, is a talisman. It's also that inherent parts of the commitment statute would no longer seem to apply to Mr. Salinas based on his performance in polygraphs. And again, this is the reason that MSOP...
Well, there's no legal support for that proposition, is there? I mean, just because he performs in a polygraph where there's no deception detected by the polygraph. First, that doesn't mean there's not deception. It just means the polygraph doesn't pick up on deception. But it also doesn't mean that the offense didn't occur. There's no finding that he didn't commit these offenses.
That's correct. The point that I'm trying to make is that when we're looking at the discharge criteria, and whether a reasonable relation exists between the original reason for commitment and the continued confinement, we're not simply saying, well, he no longer has a sexual diagnosis, so he should be discharged per Call v. Gomez. What we're arguing here is there is now a historic record of treatment within the program where they have treated him as though he only has a single victim. That was the purpose of changing
but
his...
But even if that's so, let's take that. On that issue, on that one offense about which he agrees... there seems to be a consistent professional opinion that he's not taking full account of it, that he's therefore still a danger. He hasn't effectively been treated for it. He's minimizing his behavior. He's maximizing his – trying to create an impression that is inconsistent with reality. I think that's what the professionals have said, even if there's only one offense.
I would say that the record is at best mixed on that issue, and the persons who are actually providing treatment, for instance, Ms. Olson, who testified, testified that Mr. Salinas is very transparent about his offense history. He's very, as was described in case notes that were before the panel, he was very clear and concise about his offense history. He's described what he has acknowledged as his one victim and what occurred in frankly excruciating detail when you read some of the admissions and the treatment notes that are reported. Again, there's a difference, a clear difference in opinion between persons that have provided treatment to Mr. Salinas and in this case, Dr. Lovett, who comes in and reviews this record and concludes that while he's only been transferred to CPS through his ability to deceive and manipulate, when the persons who are actually day-to-day working with Mr. Salinas don't find that at all, find that he is very credible, find that he is clear and open about his offense history. And so we have this kind of historical knowledge of treatment providers with Mr. Salinas saying one thing and polygraph records that tend to support what Mr. Salinas is saying, and an examiner who does a review of records after the fact saying, I don't buy any of this.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, please.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that individual that you're referring to that was more directly involved, that was directly involved in his treatment, mm-hmm. Did not testify that he is no longer a danger.
Such testimony would be objected to by the commissioner, and I don't think could be considered by the panel, even if that testimony was proffered. I don't think that testimony was elicited because, you know, frankly, it could not be considered by the panel because they're not a forensic expert. They cannot express an opinion about Mr. Salinas' dangerousness going forward. They are not qualified to make that assertion.
All right, counsel, I see your time has expired, unless the panel has any other questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you to both parties for your help in this case. It was well argued and well briefed. We will get an opinion out in the statutory time frame. Thank you.